WVXU's first home was on Xavier's campus. Then, 20 years ago, it became part of Cincinnati Public Radio and moved to rented space on Central Parkway. Now, your NPR station is moving to a new home for our local public radio stations in Evanston. Follow our progress at cinradio.org/move.
It's decorative gourd season, and this time of year, pumpkins reign supreme. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, our experts will tell us where the jack-o'-lantern tradition started and offer tips for keeping our carved creations fresh. They're also here to answer all of your questions about the fruits, vegetables, trees, shrubs, and flowers of your choice. Joining me now are Turner Farm Community Garden Manager, Christiana Durr. Welcome back, Christiana.
Thanks for having me back.
Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director, Peter Huttinger. Thanks for being here, yeah. Peter.
Yeah, good afternoon.
We also have Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs. Welcome back, Joe.
Glad to be back on.
And Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher. Thanks for being here, Corey.
Thanks for having me back.
They're here to answer your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Corey, I have spent much of my life confident in my knowledge that pumpkins are gourds, but I just learned, thanks to you, that they are also berries. What?
I know. So botanically speaking, every fruit is sort of categorized into a number of different categories. And berries, just because of the way that they develop, botanically speaking, pumpkins are not only not vegetables, they're fruit, and specifically they are types of berries. So when if you're referring to your pumpkin as a vegetable, not only is it not, it's a berry. And strawberries aren't berries. That also blows my mind.
What? Strawberries aren't? What are strawberries if they're not berries? And why are they called strawberries?
So strawberries are another type of fruit called achenes, and it's really the seeds along the outside of a strawberry that are the achenes. So the term berry is used popularly is not necessarily the same way that a botanist would use the term berry. So people can feel free to call strawberries berries and call pumpkins fruit. I just think it's entertaining that pumpkins, as big as they are actually berries, as are bananas. I know I'm blowing your mind.
You really are. I just don't even know if I can continue with the show today. That's how shook I am about all this. I mean, okay, Corey, I'm going to stop with the berries. What okay. is the origin story of jack-o'-lanterns? You also shared this with our producer.
It all started over a bar tap. Long ago, sometime in the, 18th, 19th century, there was supposedly this gentleman, this nefarious man named Stingy Jack in Ireland. And he one day was having a beer with the devil in a bar, and Stingy Jack did not want to pay for his beer. So he asked the devil to turn himself into a coin. And he was going to pay his bar tab with that coin, and then the devil could, become the devil again, and they could both get away without paying their tab. Well, when the devil turned himself into a coin, Jack put the devil into his pocket, but he also had a small crucifix in his pocket. And because of that crucifix, the devil couldn't turn back into himself, and so Jack was able to keep the devil hostage in his pocket. Eventually, the devil convinced Jack to let him go, but Jack made him promise that he wouldn't take his soul, and the devil agreed. Well, after that happened, once Jack died, God said, no, he doesn't want any of those nefarious characters in heaven, and the devil said, no, he still doesn't want to take Jack's soul. So Jack was doomed to roam the earth with nothing but a piece of coal to light his way, and he held the piece of coal in a carved turnip, not even in a pumpkin. He held it in a carved out turnip to light his way. And so the legend was that There was this mysterious ghost of Stingy Jack that walked around Ireland with a glowing turnip, and that slowly got turned into, a glowing pumpkin that we would carve into sort of scary faces, supposedly to scare away evil spirits from our houses.
Okay, and the carved turnips. So the carved turnips were the beginning of jack-o'-lanterns.
Correct.
Have you ever carved a turnip?
No, and I can't imagine. You would really have to really want to carve the turnip because, you know, they're solid. I can't imagine doing it. But if you look up photos of turnip jack-o'-lanterns, there are some people who still carve their jack-o'-lanterns out of turnips.
Christiana is nodding vigorously. Have you ever carved a turnip?
Absolutely not, but I've seen all of the turnip carving photos, and they're very intriguing. You should look them up.
What about you?
They're terrifying.
I have actually carved a turnip.
You have carved a turnip.
Peter. Yeah.
Peter, this, yeah, I'm so glad you're here.
Well, it's my son went to a Waldorf school, and they follow some European traditions. And as part of the curriculum, they discussed, they didn't talk about the devil deal, but they talked about the tradition of carving turnips in Europe. And in one of the classes, we did it. I mean, it was like they didn't do it in a class, we did it at home. It was a lot of work, like you said, to scoop it out. It was
You hollowed out the turnip.
Yeah, and put a couple little piercings in it, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Joe, what about you? Have you ever carved a turnip?
No, I'm just thrilled. I'm listening to this thinking, oh my goodness. I mean, that would be much smaller, but I'm not sure. I think you'd have to use a drill, wouldn't you? I mean,
well,
they're very
some
hard
of the,
turnips.
I mean, turnips can get, it's those big purple top ones, not like the tender little white salad turnips.
Did you wait till it was mushy and kind of rotten before you scooped out the guts?
No, we just kind of carved it. I mean, it wasn't particularly a good job.
Oh, Peter, don't say that.
But if I
could
just say that you can, I did it.
Okay.
For whatever that's worth.
There's bragging rights there, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we've covered the turnip territory very effectively. I'm glad we did that. Christiana, you're a mom of young children. You're carving pumpkins, not turnips. Do you have a particular pumpkin carving approach you're using this year or that you always use?
No particular approach other than we always start, the standard way of like hollowing it out. We've been practicing different techniques, I would say. That was a new little fun tradition we started this year is every weekend we go to the farm and pick out a new pumpkin and start off the weekend by carving a new design. So I've got many mushy pumpkins on my front porch looking so spooky.
Yeah, they look creepier and creepier the more sunken in and rotten looking they get.
Yeah, so we just kind of turn on a little Halloween music and with the top, we've learned that straight up and down is not the way. You have to go in at an angle so it doesn't fall through.
That's a
pro tip right there. making sure we really clean out the pumpkin has been another one. We've left some not super cleaned out, and the squirrels and critters have really just gone after those. And then we've tried different knives, too, and I really like just the little pumpkin carving kits that you can buy at the store. Amazingly effective.
Like the little baby saws in there.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got a few different ones. And so, that's been the method we've used so far.
Yeah.
Would you save the seeds and roast them?
Yes, we always save the seeds and roast them.
What is your seed roasting recipe of choice?
It's the same one I've used since I was a child, which is very straightforward. It's just clean off the guts. Those go to my chickens now, so nothing's wasted. And then for the seeds, we just rinse them off, dry them off a little bit, and then put them into the oven at 400 with some butter and salt.
You don't season them with anything else?
Nope,
just butter,
butter
and salt.
And salt.
And here's a very controversial question.
Yes.
I feel almost bad asking you this. Do you eat them the whole seed? Do you feel like you got to take the outside off and just eat the little guts
inside?
No, we
eat the whole thing. I did ever since I was a child. And I feel like it builds character, really.
Okay. So for our producer, Selena, this means Selena's right and her husband is wrong. I would like everybody in our audience to hear that.
Yes, Tim can listen to this later. I know he's at work right now.
Well, okay, another thing you can do with the pumpkins, too, if you use like a smaller pumpkin that's more like a pie pumpkin, so it has thicker flesh. My wife, Vicki, one year we did the pumpkin just like a day before with our son, and then she put it in the oven.
Put the pumpkin in the oven?
Cooked it.
And, this is after trick-or-treating.
Somewhere I have a photograph. Yeah, so we took a photograph of it before with the light in it and then in the oven after it cooked. And so it like shrunk down. So that's something really fun. Now, if your pumpkin has been on your porch for a couple of weeks, you know, you don't want to do that. But if you do it the day before, have a fresh one. And then you can just cut it up and, you know, just eat the pumpkin flesh.
Oh, okay.
That reminds me, last year we carved out a pumpkin and then baked it with chili in it. And so we had like a baked pumpkin and then put chili in it, and then you can kind of scoop out.
Like a chili pumpkin bowl instead of a chili bread bowl?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was fun.
And you know, pumpkins you can eat as a savory. I mean, you don't have to, you know, we associate it with pie, but it's actually like any like acorn squash or butternut squash. I mean, it's...
Or like multiple berries, how savory we all
think
of berries.
That's right, multiple berries, yeah. So it's there's a lot more culinary kind of uses of a pumpkin than you would think.
Okay. Well, we do have a caller on the line. Hey, Layla, thanks so much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Okay, so I'm afraid that this is not about pumpkins.
That's okay. We've really run the pumpkins down, so we're ready for your new topic.
Okay, so this is a question about oak trees. We have a pretty old oak tree in our yard. It's probably around 70 years old. And this year we've noticed for the first time that it's dropping the tip ends of the branches, just, you know, like 6 or 8 inches at the very end, are coming off. At first we thought maybe the squirrels were biting them off or something. That doesn't seem to be the case. And on the back side of the leaves, it's sort of gray in color. So I don't know if this indicates a disease or just the tree's getting old, or does anyone know what might be happening here?
That sounds like quite the mystery. Corey, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, you said this is the first time you've noticed it happening.
This year, yes.
So, I mean, there's a couple things. I mean, you know, cicadas can cause the tips of the branches of a lot of trees to fall off, but there's also other types of insects called twig pruners. Joe probably knows about these that will go out to the tips of branches and clip off just the tips. And sometimes you'll see these population cycles of some of these insects. But the fact that you said it's the first time you've never seen it, or just this year it's the first time?
Well, this year is the first time that we have really noticed it. I mean, I'm not going to say that one or two haven't fallen off previously, but there's a bunch now. And, you know, I know we had a big wind and all that, but even now, you know, the wind is not the case, and still they're falling.
Joe can tell you all about some of the pruners. I know there's an oak twig pruner insect that'll clip off the tips, but I don't know if there's been a problem with those lately. Joe, do you know if there's been an issue with any of those?
Well, they come and go, and that's very interesting because I have some great shots of one of the twig pruners. There's about 7 or 8 different species in different genera. And what happens is the populations will rise. You'll get a lot of them, and then you may not see them for years.
Okay.
It's just a natural rise. So the fact that you hadn't seen it before doesn't mean that, you know, that they weren't there before, maybe in low numbers, and maybe this year the population's a little higher. They really don't cause any appreciable harm to the overall health of the tree. In fact, it's just like, you know, tip pruning, so next year you'll get probably more foliage because you'll have buds that will break right there near where the insect fed on the tree or caused the dieback, and you just get more foliage.
Okay. Well, the main thing we were worried about was a disease or something, and, you know, if we should think about having the tree removed or whatever, but so we just wait and see, right?
That's what I do, yes.
Oh, okay. So these are called twig pruners?
Yes, they're called twig pruners, and there are many different. There are several different species with that name.
Okay. Okay. Well, look that up. Thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your call, and good luck with that tree. We'll be anxious to hear how things go with it. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today with a panel of experts here to answer your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did get a call earlier from Jane. Jane says she has dead boxwoods. What's a good replacement that can... I know, Joe's like... Corey's probably having some
Corey's
kind of PTSD
favorite,
reaction
favorite
right
plant.
Now. Yeah. What's a good replacement that can stand up to dogs relieving themselves? A plant that can be close to the sidewalk when you salt the sidewalk. Okay. Corey, I know you love a good boxwood. Yeah. Actually, you love a good replacement for a boxwood. So do you have tips for Jane? Any shrubs that dogs are not attracted to for their bathroom breaks?
So for dog bathroom breaks and for salt, that's going to be the trickier question, I think. Because I tend to be a real fan of inkberry hollies. I have them. I replace my boxwoods at my house with those. If you don't necessarily need something that can get as tall as a boxwood, one of my other favorite evergreen shrubs that seems to be pretty tough. It's a cultivar of cedar, of our eastern cedar. It's called gray owl cedar. They don't get quite as big as like the cedar trees you're used to. They stay shrubby, and those can be, they tend to behave themselves a little more, meaning they don't tend to spread out or get as leggy. They don't really need pruning. So I would suggest either looking at inkberry hollies or another native holly species, or that gray owl variety of the eastern cedar would be the ones that I would probably go with.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps, Jane. We are going to continue our gardening show after a real short break. Remember, if you've got questions, you can give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today, and we have a panel of experts to answer your questions. My guests are Turner Farm Community Garden Manager Christiana Durr, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs, and Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation Corey Christopher. If you have questions, and we know you have questions, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We got a question, a call right before the break from Violet. Violet says, hello to all the gardeners. Planted a miniature butterfly bush in a larger container. How can I protect it over the winter, and how should I water it? Corey, is that a Corey question?
I mean, if she's talking about the exotic butterfly bush, the one that's non-native, if it's in a pot, I don't know if I would leave it outside. I've had those in my yard, but they were in the ground. I think if you've got one of those in a container outside, I would be afraid if we get one of those cold winters, it may not make it through the winter. So I would suggest if she wants to really protect it through the winter to bring it inside. Or if it's if it is one of the just your sort of typical butterfly bush that you might get at a nursery, she should be able to put it in the ground. She could still do that now and have time for it to sort of be situated in the soil before winter comes.
Okay, super. We have Ellen on the line. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
I have a dogwood tree that was glorious last spring. I would say it's about 20 feet tall, and it is now losing leaves. It is the leaves look like they're dying. Should I water it?
What do you think, Joe?
I missed the very beginning because I was trying to increase my headset volume.
It's a dogwood tree about 20 feet tall. It was glorious last spring. Seems to be drying out.
Well, have you watered it this summer along the way?
I have watered it some, but not consistently. I mean, it's quite large.
Yeah, dogwoods are very susceptible to drought stress, and we've been seeing a lot of that. You know, we've gone through really kind of three periods of drought this season, but of course the last one was the most intense. And so we've been seeing dogwoods with what we call physiological leaf scorch. That just means the leaves are turning brown and dropping from that previous drought. Of course, we're back in another drought. And so I wouldn't be too concerned at this stage. You probably do want to water just to maintain the roots so they don't dry out. And then next season, you know, keep an eye on it because it was seriously stressed. But at this stage, you know, it's so late, so close to them losing their leaves anyway, that really you're not going to be able to do much for the leaves they're currently on. But I would recommend that you don't let it go into the winter with that soil very, very dry. Research done many years ago actually showed the greatest damage on trees during the winter was not from soil freezing. It was from root dehydration. So that's pretty important, particularly on conifers, but in this case, even deciduous trees.
Okay.
And you just water it around the trunk.
Well, you want to water out away from the tree a bit. If you just water around the trunk, you'll only be doing, there are some roots, some specialized roots that grow near the base of the trunk. Those get lost during the winter. So, no, you want to water out to the drip line as best you can, and even beyond if you can. But at minimally out to the drip line.
And Joe, explain what the drip line is.
Oh, okay. The drip line is the edge of where you look at the tree canopy, so where the leaves come out at the ends of the branches, all the way around the tree. That would be the drip line.
Okay. Well, yeah. Ellen, I hope that helps. Good luck with that dogwood.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. And we have Talika on the line. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question? Hi, Talika.
Hello. Oh, sorry. So I have two yellow roses that I got from Costco, and I planted them under a pine tree. It's not very shady, so it gets enough sunlight, but they're neither growing nor drying. They're literally the same height as when I planted them. So I'm not sure what exactly do they need for them to grow.
Okay. Thank you. Corey, do you have thoughts on those rose bushes?
Usually, I mean, if you plant them under a pine, roses usually like a little bit of acidic soil. But if you just planted them this year, from my experience, sometimes roses will put out, they call them canes. So it's basically just one really long, tall stem. And sometimes in the very first year that you plant them, you may not see very much growth. I probably wouldn't worry too much about it until next year. If you still see that they seem stunted, it might be an issue with the soil. You could always take a soil sample into your local extension office. But that would be the only thing I can think of. I don't know if there's some, you know, insect pest that might be bothering them. No. I don't know if you know anything, Joe.
Yeah, but Corey, we don't want to have them bring soil to our extension office. That's only over in Kentucky. So we would prefer that you just go online and take a look at getting your soil tested by downloading soil testing kits from different labs. But I'm willing to go back. I sound like a one-trick pony here, but given, you know, the situation, I want to go back to the watering that was done or not done. Did you do a lot of supplemental watering this season?
Not a lot, but I believe it was enough, like I didn't go the extra mile to water them more, but I believe it was enough.
During that first year of establishment, roses are very, very sensitive, and it really does affect the rate of establishment. Very sensitive to insufficient water. So I suspect maybe the stunting had to do with just not getting enough water. We came out of the drought and then we kind of forgot about it, I think. But everyone needs to remember, you know, and this was, I think, was even a subject, wasn't it, on one of the earlier gardening shows that, drought we weren't quite to the extreme. We weren't to the level four, but we made it to a level that seriously caused harm, and particularly newly established plants. If you still have leaves on them, then I want to go back to what I said earlier about you should start watering them now. Make sure that root system don't want to overwater because they are subject to root rotting. But you want to make sure that soil is not powder dry, and that will definitely impede establishment.
You know, another thing too, when people plant around trees, you got to remember that whatever you plant around that tree is going to be in competition with that
absolutely,
fruit,
Corey.
With the tree, and the tree is going to win.
Yeah,
it's just much bigger if it's a mature tree. So just be mindful of that, and it goes to supports what Joe said, obviously, about watering.
Yeah, thank you for that, Peter.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
I thought, Corey, you were going to say you ought to replace them with boxwoods. Is that what I was doing?
No,
sorry, I couldn't help it.
please don't.
Well, good luck with those rose bushes, Talika. I hope that helps. We appreciate your listening and
thank
your calling.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
And now we have Helen on the line. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a boxwood dilemma again.
Corey.
What has happened?
Okay. Go ahead. We're ready for you.
I have several boxwoods across the front, and two of them, they were dead after what happened. You know, I've been watering everything every day practically to keep everything alive around here. And now the boxwoods that we were getting ready to dig out and replace have started leaves all again inside and all around the outside. So I don't know if they're dead or alive. I don't know what to do now. I don't really want to take them out if they're going to live. So what do they think is happening?
Now, describe that again. You're having what was happening around the outside and inside?
Well, it was all, you know, how they, whenever we had that boxwood problem, I had a lot of dead sides and all the rest of them, but I clipped those out and they're coming back. And then these two we thought were dead because they were just completely dry and looked all fuzzy and everything inside. But now that we were getting ready to dig them out, there's new leaves all on the inside and all on the outside. It's leafing out nice and green and lovely.
Okay.
So what happened?
Okay. Well, it's a Monty Python boxwood. They're not dead yet, right? I mean, I know you all were thinking it now. I know you were.
Watch for killer rabbits in your yard, Helen.
That's right. Helen, I think this really speaks to why boxwoods... Corey and I disagree on this. That I really like them because it's called rejuvenation pruning. So boxwoods can be cut back. They can be cut back, particularly if they're well established. They can be cut back near the ground and they will regrow. So when they get out of bounds, this is what we recommend people do. So that boxwood is just doing what it's capable of doing. I have a feeling what happened was the disease that we were really having a problem with was called Volatella blight, and it is a stem cankering disease. Sometimes cankers cause death of stems. Sometimes they progress all the way down to the base and can kill the tree if it goes in the main stem, but other times those cankers kind of run out. They stop, and then we'll start seeing regrowth below. So that means that if you'd like to have those boxwoods come back, believe it or not, by sometime next year, if you cut back the dead and leave the green, leave what has leaves on it, there's a very good probability you'll start seeing boxwoods, if there's a good root system, very rapidly filling back in. They're kind of remarkable that way. So that's what I believe is happening. You probably had, it sounds like you had it on the other boxwoods, you're able to prune out the Boletelli cankers, but these have just progressed a little further, and that's what's happened.
And I will say kudos to you too for being patient, because one of the tips I give people yeah. all the time is just when you think something's wrong, be patient. And oftentimes things sort of resolve on their own. So, so good for you for waiting it out.
Yeah. Now, would you recommend she prune now or wait till March?
That's a great question. Actually, it would be better. Well, if the stem tissue is dead, Peter, it won't matter. I mean, you're just pruning out the dead tissue, which is a good idea anyway. However, if you get into the green tissue, we don't want to stimulate more green, right, Peter? I mean, you can end up through the winter having winter damage. So it's actually a little better for listeners out there. If you have boxwood you want to reshape doing this rejuvenation pruning, that was a nice catch, Peter. Don't do it now. Wait until very early spring, and because we don't want the new foliage that will come back in, perhaps even yet this fall, to be damaged by the winter, because that'll be tender foliage.
Okay. I hope that helped, Helen. We're going to say goodbye and move on to the next caller. Hey, Susan, thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I have another pruning question. I have, I have some barberry and spirea that need to be cut back quite a bit. And I'd like to know, like, about how far down I can cut them back and about what time of year.
Do you have thoughts on this, Peter?
I've not worked with barberry at all. So, you know, maybe Corey, you with that? That's more of a native plant as opposed to like blueberry or something you'd be harvesting for edible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would probably, at least for the spirea, I would rather do that in the spring if it was me. But you can cut them back. Actually, for both, I would say do it in early spring or late winter is when I would prune it. I mean, you can trim them back pretty far. I don't know what particular species of either you've got, but I probably, if it was me, I would wait till very early spring or very late winter before I pruned them back.
I hope that helps, Susan. Thanks for calling. We're going to try to get another caller. Hey, Steve, thanks so much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yes, I have a comment about the origins of the jack-o'-lantern.
Oh, good.
Story. When I was a small child, I was born and raised in America, but my family is Irish from Canada. And my grandmother and my mother would cook up this dish called turnips, and they were dark orange. And it wasn't until I was in my late 20s, 30s, that I found out that the Americans call those rutabagas.
Oh.
And those small little purple turnips, we never cook those up. But the Americans call those small little purple ones, call those turnips. So I would think that the rutabaga is more easily carved out, because you can get those at quite a large size that would hold a burning piece of coal or a candle.
Oh, Steve, this is such a good point. Thank you so much for calling. What did you carve, Peter? Did you carve a rutabaga?
No, it was just a really big turnip.
Really big turnip. Okay.
Biggest one we could find.
Yeah. We do have rutabagas growing in the garden right now. Maybe that can be on our list.
There you go. That's something for you to do with your kids, Christiana. Thank you, Steve. Yeah. That was a great call. I appreciate that.
And to advocate rutabaga, I mean, when you get a rutabaga in the store, it's like usually coated with wax and they're not all that tasty, but a fresh rutabaga is a whole different thing. I mean, they're really pretty exceptional.
Okay. Well, we have a couple other callers on the line. Please be patient with us because we're going to take a quick break. Now's the time to ask your questions. You can call 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the home stretch of our gardening show. My guests are Turner Farm Community Garden Manager Christiana Durr, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs, and Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation Corey Christopher. If you have questions, now's the time. Call 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We're getting into lightning round territory because we have some callers on the line. We have some emails. So let's start with you, Paula. Thanks so much for your patience. What's your question?
First, I want to say I'm so grateful for this program because I think I had so many things on my checklist and I've got about half of them already checked off. So boxwood was covered. We're good there. And then roses and, of course, pumpkins and gourds and stuff. But I was just a little curious about a little bit more about the community gardens. And is everyone invited? Is it something that we can start almost like start over from the ground up? Really get some education there, or is it something you have to be in the region of that community center or community gardens to go?
Well, there's a number of different organizations that have community gardens. You know, speaking to Turner Farms, everybody is welcome. Our main garden is in Price Hill. We also have a garden in the East End, and we have one in Winton Terrace, and we work with a couple other ones around the city. But very few gardens restrict you to have to be in, you know, that neighborhood. Another good source for a large network of community gardens is the Civic Garden Center. So where Turner Farm is set up is that the Price Hill Community Garden is a half-acre fenced area, and we do almost all of our education there. The gardening there is that they're set up as row crops. People don't have individual beds, but you all work collectively and sharing the harvest and the work, and we find that leads to a lot more stress in terms of maintenance and higher productivity, and building a sense of community is important too. And so we're there on Tuesday and Saturday mornings. You feel free, and it's, all our programs are free in the gardens. I don't know, Christiana, is there something you want to add? Christiana is the manager of the Price Hill Garden now.
Yeah, so feel free to stop by the Price Hill Garden. Like Peter said, on Tuesdays and Saturdays, we're there with our work sessions. Our work sessions start at 9:30 a.m. and end around noon. But we have people stop there all the time just to ask gardening questions, if they're starting a garden, you know, if they have something going on in their yard. So yeah, feel free to stop by. We'd love to have you.
Yeah, and we do like to point out, I mean, we do what's called, we used to do more formalized work and learn sessions, and we still kind of do some of those, and we do a series of classes every year. But if you have questions and or if you're having a problem with your vegetable crops, you know, chances are if you stop by the garden, we're all in the same region, we're probably battling the same issues.
Yeah, feeling the same pain. Well, Paula, thanks so much. We appreciate your listening. Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. Now we have Daniel on the line. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. Thank you. Hate to do this, but I'd like to go back to the oak tree issues. I have witnessed several very old oak trees in my neighborhood in Oakley being cut down in just the past 2-3 years. In my estimation, they're probably about 200-year-old trees. And I question whether they really need to come down. So I have two parts to my question. How can you tell? And secondly, the tree companies that come out and the arborists that they send out, I can't imagine that they aren't under the pressures of some type of liability if they tell you that your tree is fine and you can carry on enjoying it, as opposed to, oh, there's a few dead branches, it's dying, it's a threat to your safety, you should take it down. So how do you get through all of that? The current tree that my neighbor is about to take down is dropping hordes of acorns like never before. You can shovel them off the driveway every 2 days. And if you look at the tree from a distance, some of the tip branches do look dry and dying. So it does look like it's failing in some regard.
Go ahead, Joe.
You want me to handle that? Yeah. And it's a very good question because, you know, from afar, when we watch trees coming down, sometimes we wonder why. There is, for all the listeners out there, a very important point here in terms of getting professional help with your large trees. And then you start with contacting an International Society of Arboriculture, ISA. Certified arborist. That's just the beginning. But in that certification realm, we also have a very special qualification. It's called tree risk assessment qualification or track. Now, if you do have a tree that you're concerned about, you're saying to yourself, well, this tree's large, it has some challenges, it's overhanging the house, then make sure that you visit the ISA website, International Society of Arboriculture. You can search by zip code, and then you can ask, you can look for that track qualification. And that's very important because, as a matter of fact, in our region, we have quite a few track qualified arborists, and that is a qualification that involved lawyers in terms of putting together the training. So when you talked about liability issues and so on and so forth, yeah, that's part of that entire qualification.
I hope that helps, Daniel. I apologize. We're going to have to hang up and go to our next caller because we are running out of time. Hi, Charlie. Thanks for your call. What's your question?
So during the storms, we lost a large box elder in the back of the property. And very recently, we've noticed almost an infestation right by our rose bushes on the front of the house. And I'm curious if I can, I've looked up the right pesticide to kind of get rid of them, but I'm curious if it's an issue for the house and for the roses and how freely I can spray that pesticide in that area.
Joe, you have some advice?
Talk about that? Yeah, if you go online, look, listeners, if you want to do BYGL, Buckeye Yard and Garden Line, I just posted on this last week. Those are most likely box elder bugs. They're not going to cause any harm inside your home or outside of your home. They're gathering at this time of the year to try to find an overwintering site. So the best thing you can do, quite frankly, is to make sure that you have your home sealed. You know, make sure that around the windows and so forth, it's properly caulked and door sweeps are in good shape and so on and so forth. But it really doesn't justify an application of insecticide unless you're really being plagued with large numbers coming into your home. They feed on seeds. They feed on the seeds of box elder, which of course is a type of maple, meaning they feed on the seeds of maple as well. So they really don't cause any harm to speak of. They're a nuisance pest. And so I would just wait it out unless you're having them come in your home. But even there, that just means you need to seal up your house a little better.
Thanks, Charlie. I hope that helps. And we will include that link that Joe just mentioned on our website. That is Joe's blog, and it has lots of terrific information all the time. We also got some emails I hope we can get to real quickly. Doug from Cincinnati writes, about 8 years ago, we planted 3 Norway spruce in our backyard. They've been doing great. But just last week, I noticed that one of them was losing a lot of needles. The others look okay. Does this sound like a drought issue? If so, is it too late to save it, or could it be some kind of bug or fungus? Corey, you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, so spruce will lose their leaves because of drought. So they are susceptible to drought. And I think we've, you know, like Joe said, we're in one now and we just got out of one at the end of the summer. There is also I think it's a fungus. There's a needle, they call it a needle cast disease.
Yeah, Rhizosphera.
Yeah, that's it. And I know that's going around, and I know that drought can make spruce more susceptible to that. The fact that you've only got one of your trees that seem to be dying, I don't know, Joe. Do you see individual trees being more susceptible to that cast disease? Because drought and that cast disease are the only two things I can think of that would be, I mean, right now, that would be causing that issue.
I'd say given the timing and given the timing of planting, Corey, Rhizosphere is not a real big problem on Norways, more on blues. I mean, okay. They could get it. Also, it's a fungal disease that tends to hit established older trees. I would say it's drought. I mean, we've been seeing that. We saw it in previous droughts. The Norways just simply, and other spruces, can really struggle, as you said, Corey, in drought. So it's too late to do much about the one that's losing needles. I mean, it wouldn't hurt to water, and I like what you said, Corey, have some patience for next year. However, at this point, if it's losing a lot of needles, it may be too far gone. But make sure and water those others. And again, make sure that soil is not dry going into the winter. because conifers continue to transpire through the winter. And so we need to make sure that soil is not bone dry.
Okay, we also have an email from Sonia. Sonia emails, in one of your previous shows, you talked about proper hygiene if a plant has fungus, as if it was obvious. What exactly does following the proper hygiene entail? If one of your tomato plants, for example, or a tree has fungus, how do you dispose of the mulch on your garden bed? Or if it's a tree that leaves when they, if it's a tree, the leaves when they fall, should I burn them, compost them, put them in the city bins? And how important is it to get every last little leaf? Peter, what do you think about this?
Well, you definitely, I mean, hygiene is a big thing when you're putting your garden to bed in the going into winter. So taking those tomato plants and you can put them in yard waste pickup, I would recommend that. You're really not supposed to do open burning in the city or probably even the state. So, you know, I would bypass that. You can rake up the mulch and you can add that to your into your bag or into your lawn waste. But, you know, every single lead, you want to get as much as you can off. But, you know, there's, you know, you also don't want to scrape the soil and leave it completely bare over winter. So what you can do is remove the existing mulch that you have down and then put new mulch on top of where you've removed the plants. But do with the tomatoes, do also remove the roots.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have one email from our friend Marshall Verbsky, who's usually our technical director on the show. Should I take my baby grapevine clipping inside for the winter? Will it still go dormant if I do? Peter, is this? This seems like another Peter question.
Well, if it's in a pot, you know, you could take it and put it in an unheated basement or an unheated garage and do that. Or else you could just take, you really want to acclimate it to this region's temperatures. So there's a process we call healing in. If you don't have a place where you want to plant it, you can dig a small hole and just fit the pot into it and put some mulch around it. But one of the things you have to be careful about with if outdoors, don't cover the whole thing with straw or leaves, because you could end up in a situation where you make nice habitat for voles. Oh. And they will eat the bark and girdle the plant. So, I mean, that would be either way, but you definitely don't want to bring it into a heated house. That's just going to confuse the thing.
They'll make a jack-o'-lantern out of it, right? Is that what
there you go, yeah.
Ah, yes.
Well, thanks for bringing us full circle on that, Joe. Joe, I'll ask you, coming back to jack-o'-lanterns, do you have any great tips for our listeners for how, once you've carved that jack-o'-lantern, to keep it looking great through Halloween? I've heard, like, Vaseline on the edges. I mean, what do you do, or do you even worry about it?
I don't worry about it, other than putting it up so that kids can't grab it and smash it. That's about that. Putting it high up somewhere where people can't get to it.
So you worry more about the humans and the squirrels and stuff, it sounds
yes,
like.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, I've been talking with Turner Farm Community Garden Manager, Christiana Durr, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director, Peter Huttinger, Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs, and Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Ella Rowan. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.